Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for coming along with me and with us as we take this ride towards criminal justice reform, as we look to do exactly what we are set out to do, and that is to bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. I know it's an uphill battle, but it's one that's worth fighting for, and it's one that we can actually achieve. If we have the heart for it and we put our minds to it, we can certainly do it. I want to remind you all to rate, subscribe, and share these episodes. Please comment, leave me a feedback, whether it's through the website or whatever platform that you're listening to this podcast on, iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Spreaker, Podbean, wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Rate it, subscribe to it, share it, and like I said, leave a comment. Don't be afraid to leave a comment. That way I can know how to make the show better and what you all think about the show. Remember, I can be reached at cptlhunter@gmail.com, cptlhunter@gmail.com. Once again, I'm available for speaking engagements. If you have a promotional test coming up, I'm your man. Come to me. We can help to get you ready for your promotional exam. Or if you want to become a police officer, or if you just have a regular routine exam, regular opportunity for a job or for an employment opportunity, or if you are looking to advance interview working outside of law enforcement. A lot of times people are not realizing what they're doing wrong in these job applications and job interview process. People are dressing wrong, their body language is wrong, and turning people off. So I'm your man to come to in order to correct some of the deficiencies and help you get that job or promotion that you are seeking. Remember that you can support the podcast through Cash App, PayPal, Venmo, and also through the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon. So those are the ways that you can support the podcast. All of those are CPTL Hunter. Remember to follow me on Twitter, CPTL Hunter, Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook. And remember to head over to the website, hunterpolicetraining.com. I want to do a little marketing campaign here, if you all can help me out. So if you could answer a few questions for me, I think I have about four questions. If you could just answer them for me. You can email me, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram or Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook. Leave me a message there or Instagram me or instant message me or text message me if you have my phone number. I want to know, first of all, how did you find out about the podcast? Was it word of mouth? Did I tell you? Did you come across it on LinkedIn? Did you come across it accidentally? Were you Google searching for other items? How did you find out about the podcast? Second question is, why are you listening, right? Is it certain topics? Are you listening because I'm your friend? Are you listening because of certain interviewees, certain guests that I'm having on? So why are you listening? Are you a friend of someone who I interviewed and you only paid attention because of that in that particular episode or maybe this episode? So if you could just answer that question for me. I want to know if you're subscribed or not. And the reason I want to know that is because I want to know if you are getting notifications when new episodes come out. And I also want to know, do you download the episodes and take them with you or just listen to them on the internet or through the website? Now, I'm only asking for marketing purposes because I want to make sure that this message is getting out to more people, and I'm looking for marketing strategies. And so therefore, I'm asking for these particular questions. If you email me, text message me or Instagram me or whatever, don't worry. I'm not going to put you on some kind of email blast list. I personally hate those as well. So I just really want to know how to get this message out there. So your input would be greatly appreciated. Those questions, once again, are: how did you find out about the podcast? Why are you listening? Do you get notifications? And finally, do you download or just listen to them on the website? So if you could answer those questions for me, I truly would appreciate it. It only helps to make the podcast better, and we really want it to go and to grow. And once again, in order to reach me, cptlhunter@gmail.com, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook, Instagram is cptlhunter, Twitter is cptlhunter. All of those, I should be able to get messages through. Once again, I'm on Facebook, Lawrence Hunters. You can send me a personal message, or you can send me a text message if you have my phone number. Just let me know how you are listening. Also, you can leave a comment on these different platforms, Spotify, Spreaker, Breaker, TuneIn, whatever, iHeartRadio and all that kind of stuff. So I look forward to hearing from you all about that. So we have a great episode for you today. We have Kate Diadamo. She works in an advocacy group that is dealing with sex workers, sex traders, people who trade for sex. I know it's going to be a very controversial episode, but really had a great time speaking. And so I really know that you're going to enjoy this conversation. So let me just read to you a little bit about Kate's bio. Kate Diadamo is a partner at Reframe Health and Justice, a queer and trans people of color collective working at the intersection of anti-oppression, harm reduction, healing justice, and upending criminal legal system. Kate draws on a background in community organizing, policy advocacy, training, and capacity building, and rewriting narratives under the broad red umbrella of sex worker rights. Kate uses she, they pronouns, believes in decriminalization and divestment, and locates the power of change in local communities determining their own future. We had a great conversation. Kate is another one of the persons who I met in a conference in St. Louis in November. We recorded the episode quite some time ago, so I do apologize for her for taking so long to get this episode out, but I think it was going to be well worth the wait. And I know that you all are going to be very much engaged in this conversation. So enough about me going on. Here is the interview with Kate Diadamo as we talk about sex workers and should the sex trade become legalized. So thank you for coming to Captain Hunter's podcast. I'm speaking with Kate Diadamo. I hope I said that right. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate this conversation.
No, it's something that I'm really looking forward to. I wanted to have a conversation about this topic for some time now, and that's just sex trafficking and prostitution and sex work and all that kind of stuff. And if I can just give you a little backstory, when I was a police officer, and by that I mean, you know, 2, 3, 4 years on, I always was very curious as to why the ladies of the evening were always out there. And so I would pull up to them and I would talk to them, even if I had a partner, just kind of have a conversation with them, you know, why? Because we had streetwalkers I don't want to be offensive in my terms, but we, you know, streetwalkers, prostitutes, whatever. And so I would always kind of talk to them and try to figure out why they were doing what they were doing. And so many times I would understand that, that they did what they did for survival sex, for, because they got hooked on drugs and, things like that. So it was very, always interesting to me. I guess I always had some type of heart and compassion, for this line of work, and for what they did, right? My time as a police officer was not just, you know, or lock them up, arrest them, but I tried to understand where they were coming from. I hope I'm saying that and that makes sense to you.
No, it absolutely does. You know, I'm really excited for this conversation because I was a community organizer in New York. And I use language around folks that trade sex. I try to use really people first language, similar to, you know, people who use drugs or substances, people that trade sex, very similar. And so probably at the same time that you were working in New York, I was organizing in New York.
Okay. I was actually in Connecticut, so I was just one state over, so yeah.
Don't worry, people are mobile.
So just tell us, I did read your bio to the audience, so just tell us a little bit more about yourself and the organization that you work for.
Sure. I work at Reframe Health and Justice. We are a queer, trans, people of color consulting collective who work at the intersections of harm reduction, criminal legal reform, and healing justice. And my background, as I was saying, was with folks that trade sex. So we work with a lot of different populations that really access harm reduction spaces, are impacted by the criminal legal system. And so from my organizing background, I moved into advocacy, policy work, training service providers to better serve folks that trade sex, and continue to organize a little bit today. And so that's really the perspective that I bring to my work. I believe that change comes and lives in the hearts and minds of community members. And, you know, community members are the experts on these experiences and really know what it means to support health, rights, and safety.
This idea of harm reduction is something that's fairly new to me. You and I met at this drug rehab I keep saying drug rehab, drug reform conference back in St. Louis, you know, a few weeks back. And that idea of a harm reduction was something that was floated around a lot that I, as a former police officer coming into this, was not used to and did not understand. So can you just explain what you mean by harm reduction?
Sure. And, you know, I think the term harm reduction has really taken on a life and a pathway that has removed it a little bit from some of its roots. You know, harm reduction is really just identifying the places in our lives where we face the risk of harm and trying to mitigate that through maybe changing our behaviors or changing our the way that we go about those behaviors. You know, now we talk about things like supervised consumption sites, but you know, when we're talking about harm reduction and especially through policy change, the thing that I always point to is seatbelts. You know, there's a risk with every time you get into a car. And so we saw that risk. We recognized that we wanted to address it. And so passed something that encouraged seatbelts to be put in every single car and really tried to push for that, not only to become something that was an opportunity because your car had them, but also to engage in culture change work to really normalize that behavior. And harm reduction, when you're talking about people who are trading sex, people who are using substances, it's the exact same mindset. We're not necessarily talking about saying, well, you have to stop doing X, Y, or Z, but we recognize that these are behaviors that for a lot of different reasons, and often really structural reasons, face harm and risk. And so we are going into community spaces when we're doing it right and saying, what are the spaces where you identify a risk of harm? And what are the ways that we can adapt our behavior or create spaces for you where that doesn't have to be true? I'm not going to ask you to stop. I'm just going to say that I value your life. I value your safety. I value your well-being. And I want to make things safer for you.
Very good. Now, you obviously would face a lot of pushback as you talked about consumption safe spaces. Is that what you said? Consumption safe spaces?
Safe consumption sites.
Safe consumption
sites. And this, you know, I know it got brought up a lot at the conference we were at. There's spaces that exist all over the world in a lot of different cities where people can go use substances, where there's, you know, if they are injecting, there are clean needles. If they're smoking, there are, you know, things that they could do that with a lower risk to their health. And then where there's someone there. So if there is a risk of overdose, there is someone immediately there ready to take care of you. You know, there's bananas so you don't have to pass out because you're low in potassium. You know, they are spaces that are constructed to say, if you're going to consume substances, okay, we want you to do it safely and we don't want you to die.
That's got to be such a hard sell. And I'm going to be honest with you, it's a hard sell with me as well to have that. Now, how are you trying to sell that to the more conservative population who says people are not to, well, I don't want this to be strictly about drugs. We want to talk about sex trafficking sex workers. How do you convince the more conservative people that being in a safe space as far as the sex work is something that they should tolerate in their communities?
You know, I think it's really interesting, and I'm really glad that you asked that. It was very funny. My dad's family is from Philadelphia, and the last time I went back, I was talking about safe consumption sites, and you know, there is this conversation about safe consumption happening in Philly very much, both on a community level, but on a policy level. So Philly wanted to open up a safe consumption site, an official one. And the Department of Justice basically said no. And so right now they're kind of in legal battles to try to see what's possible. And it's because the city said, you know, we are dealing with really serious overdose problem. Opening a space where people can do this safely isn't about, you know, there's a fear of encouraging substance use. And that isn't what's happened in spaces where they've done this around the world. The big change is that there has not been a single overdose death in a safe consumption site across the globe since they've opened these. And so when you're talking about a city, you know, we can talk about the needs of substance users. Substance users need more, they need affirming housing, need access to, we all need access to better healthcare in a way that actually meets our needs. And so, yes, there's a lot of different things. We can't just talk about safe consumption as the only need. of someone who's using substances, or a safe place to trade sex for people who are trading sex. But what we're talking about is trying to address overdose. And so I was talking to my uncle, who's very conservative, and I was explaining this. And at the end of the conversation, he just said, you know, I would really love for people to, eventually stop using and to get jobs. And I was like, well, you know, you can, we agree on that. We don't agree on that. I actually don't mind if people are using substances. But, you know, I can see that as a value. And he kind of paused and he said, but no one can get a job if they're dead. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, so what you're saying is that safe consumption sites just prevent death? And I said, yeah. And he said, all right, then I guess they make sense. And so we have to talk about the widespread needs of people who are sex workers, who are substance users. There's a lot of different places where people experience risk and harm. But when we're talking about a lot of things that are happening right now, what we're talking about is avoiding death. It's about avoiding violence. And so, you know, let's talk about community complaints. Are you afraid of garbage? Let's talk about, say, well, I'm afraid that people are going to be hanging out. People who use and value those spaces don't want to bother other neighbors. They don't want that attention. And they're great neighbors to be around. And at the end of the day, sex workers and drug users are part of our communities. So many people who trade sex are caregivers. They're the ones who are keeping people housed and fed. Sex workers are part of the network and the fabric of our very rich and robust communities. And this is just about treating people like that.
Yeah, this is going to be a tough sell. As I said, I think that you said that you don't mind people using drugs. I guess we are going to talk a little bit about drugs. Did I hear you right? And could you explain that a little bit more? You don't want people to be, explain that. I'm a little lost at that.
Yeah, it doesn't harm me if someone else is using substances. And I don't consider that necessarily something to stigmatize or something to problematize. There are plenty of people out there who are substance users, who are wonderful community members, who are fantastic caregivers. The places where people use substances really get, caught up in a lot of this. And I'll also be really frank that my focus is really folks that trade sex. But it's not too dissimilar. I'm not trying to stop anyone from doing anything that they consider really a part of their life and they want to continue. I just care about their health and safety and their well-being.
Fair enough. So let's try to stay on topic here. Let's try to stay on topic. So the sex, there's a differentiation between sex trafficking and those who are voluntarily working sex traders, workers. Just can you talk a little bit about that and a little bit about more of your focus as to what it is you're trying to get people to do? You don't want people to stop doing it. You just want them to be careful and safe as they're doing it. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah. And I will say, you know, we sometimes draw this line that says there are sex workers over here and there are survivors of trafficking over there. And not only is that really not reflective of most people's lives, it's also not something you do in any other industry. Trafficking is a form of exploitation that happens through forced fraud or coercion. And it happens in an assortment of different industries. When I work in trafficking spaces, the people that I can talk to most and who I connect with most are often organizers of farm labor and agricultural workers who are experiencing exploitation. And very similarly, you're talking about an industry that doesn't necessarily have wage and hour protections. And so how do you think about fair wages or exploitative wages when you don't have a baseline? Or working with folks that are organizing domestic workers where they don't necessarily work in a factory model where you can organize and collectively bargain. And so what do labor-based protections look like outside of that collective bargaining space? And also, you know, these are industries where because we lack labor protections, because informal labor is great for people who need that kind of informal workplace, all of these things are make people more vulnerable to be exploited. And so when we talk about trafficking, I think it's really important to make sure that we're contextualizing this as exploitation in labor and not necessarily as something unique to the sex industry. And in addition, when we talk about domestic work, we don't say, well, there's domestic workers and then there's trafficking victims. We recognize that just because people are exploited, they may still see this work. We also recognize that because there's this delineation of trafficking, their experiences might not be that different from people who don't meet the definition for whatever technicality that we have created because we needed a legal framework. And we also lastly recognize that when we're trying to prevent trafficking from happening, it's addressing the vulnerabilities in people's lives that are being exploited. And it's about raising the standards that we have for these individual industries and making sure that that happens through community empowerment and through individual empowerment and addressing the needs that are being exploited by someone else. And so trafficking in the sex trade absolutely does happen. And and people have experiences that, you know, we talk about a constellation of experience. Sometimes people are involved by choice. Sometimes people are involved by circumstance. Most people are involved by circumstance. And some people, while they're trading sex, experience exploitation. All three of those things are true. People can move between all three of those categories and very often do. And just because you've experienced one thing doesn't negate that you can experience the other and move around very frequently between those three experiences.
Do you work with other groups who are being exploited? I assume that you just work with sex traffickers. Do you work with those, like you said, the farm workers, domestic help? Do you work with any of those other, or are there groups that would address those specific issues?
Oh, there's absolutely groups that do anti-trafficking work in other forms of labor. And I love working with service providers, community organizations that work in anti-exploitation spaces and, you know, work in economic justice spaces and maybe not recognize it. What they do is prevention of trafficking or identification of trafficking, even if they don't necessarily say, well, I'm a service provider that does anti-trafficking work. Making sure that people have access to resources, have access to community and spaces where they can talk, where they can connect to other people. And if something goes wrong, making sure that they have the ability to leave that situation. All of those are really important facets of doing anti-trafficking work, regardless of whether or not you call it that. My organizing is very much, you know, it's community organizing, it's labor organizing. It just happens to be with an area that where we have to fight to recognize that sex work is work.
Very good. How big of a problem is this? Can you give the audience a little bit of a problem? And I'll tell you a story. Right when I was promoted to the rank of sergeants, which is about, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe 19, 20 years ago, or something like that. We went into a house. There was some kind of argument on the street, some kind of loud chaos on the street. We end up spilling into this house, and we see a lot of, I believe they were Asian, maybe Cambodian, I don't know what they were, Vietnamese, something, females. None of them spoke English, and they were all, they sit around having the drugs in front of them. I think they had crack in front of them. So it became evident to us at that time that these were all, we didn't call them sex workers, but we understood that there was something going on here, and we couldn't identify it at the time, but we knew enough to call the FBI and you know, to see what was going on here. So that was my first introduction into this world. And since then, we've had trainings on it. I mean, I'm sure that most police departments are getting trainings on sex workers or sex trafficking or just trafficking in general. So how big of a problem is this?
You know, I will say that when we're talking about numbers, when we're talking about, you know, populations facing harm in a variety of different ways, we don't have great numbers. And B, I'm not totally sure that those numbers matter as much as we think they do. So for folks that are trading sex, and, you know, it's also really important. So sex work is really, for a lot of different communities and for a lot of people, sex work is the safety net that we should be providing otherwise. So what that means is for people who have non-traditional schedules, for people who are caregivers and want to raise their kids, for people who have criminal records, for people who are trans and gender non-conforming, for people who face discrimination from formal employment in a lot of different ways for a lot of different reasons. We don't have a lot of resource options for them. We don't have a lot of jobs that are available for people, especially when you check off multiple boxes. And so for folks that are barred from accessing traditional resources, the sex industry can be really, really important. We don't necessarily have numbers as far as, you know, how many adults have ever engaged in commercial sex in their life. I think the last time I saw a number that was even attempting to do that, they said like 1% of adult women in the US. And I have no idea even if that's close. But what I do know is that for populations that experience what is often socially sanctioned discrimination and stigma, the sex industry shows up very often when no one else does. You said before people were doing it for survival because they were substance users, and it's really hard to get a job when you're a substance user. It's really hard to stay in a shelter when you're a substance user. And so what options do we have for people? It's cruel. And there's one national survey called the U.S. Transgender Survey, USTS. 20% of trans-identified respondents said that they had traded sex for resources. And when you broke that down by race, it got even higher. 33% of Latinx trans folks said that they had traded sex for resources. 42% of Black trans women had reported engaging in commercial sex. And we know that those are replicated throughout the LGBT community. When you're talking about youth, young people who are queer are 7 times more likely to trade sex than their straight identified peers. Trans youth are 8 times more likely to trade sex for shelter than cis identified peers. And so what that tells us is that there's a lot of people who are participating in the commercial sex trade because they don't have a lot of other options. And the way that folks identify harm is pretty widespread in terms of the number of different experiences. You know, there's health risks involved. And so people identify that as one thing. You know, when we distribute condoms, we're doing harm reduction work. Interpersonal violence is something that people identify, that sex workers absolutely identify as a risk of harm. And so we do things like teaching people how to screen potential clients for safety. How do you make sure that you're in a space that you know? And then, of course, just like other forms of informal labor, that is supportive of criminalized people, of undocumented folks, exploitation is something that absolutely happens. And some of that exploitation reaches the level of trafficking, which is exploitation plus, like I said, force, fraud, or coercion. Sometimes there's a lot of exploitative behavior that doesn't necessarily count. When you're talking about strippers or dancers, paying exorbitant house fees just to show up to work is pretty exploitative, but it doesn't meet the level of trafficking. And so I very much think that, yes, talking about trafficking is important. I do anti-trafficking work. We have to talk about it. Talking about it outside the context of exploitation and outside of all the different ways that sex workers are identifying harm and identifying harm at significantly higher rates, I think is a little unfair. And it centers an anti-trafficking response and not sex workers' needs. And the other reason that I say that we kind of get caught up on the numbers sometimes, is because when we look at prevalence, the question we should be asking is, for people who are experiencing exploitation, what is the right way to reach those folks? What is the right way to get them out of that situation? And what are the services, resources, and support that they need to not end up in an exploitative situation? Because re-trafficking is a thing. People get out of their trafficking situations and they are faced with the same exact barriers that ended them in that situation before. And so I feel like the question that we too often ask is, of people who are trading sex, how many are trafficked? The question that we need to be asking is, for people who are experiencing harm in the sex trade, what do they need and what can I offer?
And does your organization offer them those services does your organization offer them those services?
So the organization that I work for, and I work alongside other organizations, we're not a service provider. All of us have backgrounds of community organizing with either sex workers or substance users or both. But we ourselves are not a service provider. We just work, we do policy work, we do community organizing work, and we work alongside community organizations and direct service providers. And very often end up making a lot of referrals and doing a lot of individual case advocacy. And so I will say that, A, there are so few resources that go towards survivors of trafficking that it should embarrass us as a country. For a country that really tries to pat ourselves on the back for an anti-trafficking response, most of the money doesn't actually go to survivors of trafficking. It goes to an infrastructure of anti-trafficking. And while I think, you know, it's really important to be able to fund case managers, I think a great case manager, it can make a massive difference in people's lives. I don't know a single good case manager who isn't constantly frustrated and heartbroken over the lack of resources that are available to someone that comes to them in a trafficking situation.
So
low barriers.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So that's for people who are identified, meet the definition of trafficking. Low barrier services that are available to folks that trade sex that actually meet the needs in their life are even smaller. And they're even harder to get access to. We just don't have enough housing for people that's available to them. We don't have enough living wage jobs. We don't have enough living wage jobs that are able to work with people who are neurodivergent, who are parents, who are students. Meaningful anti-trafficking work is meaningful anti-poverty work, and it's meaningful community empowerment work. And those resources are few and far between. The other challenge is that, so the way that sex work is criminalized, and this is true in every single state, and that Nevada is a slight exception, but sex work, independent sex work, is still criminalized in Nevada. And Nevada is actually the highest arrest state per capita in the whole country. And so one of the challenges, and especially when you're talking about harm reduction, is that so the way that sex work is criminalized in every state is that selling sex is criminalized. Buying sex is criminalized. In a lot of places, you have loitering laws. So in New York, loitering for the purposes of prostitution is really a profiling-based law. And things that are cited as evidence end up being someone, the way they're dressed, the neighborhood that they're in. And up until a couple years ago, carrying condoms was enough to be arrested for loitering for the purposes of prostitution.
Wow.
And so, yeah. A few years ago, we were able to pass a very narrow ban on that practice. But right now, almost every state, that's still legal.
But this is because of the more conservative people who don't want it, right? Who are looking out their windows, whether they're driving by or outside their neighborhoods, and don't want these sex workers walking around their neighborhood. So if we provided them with safe spaces, as you mentioned, you know, maybe a home for them to go to, would they be more tolerant of that?
I mean, they're doing a lot of sting operations right now, and they're doing sting operations for people who are based online, who aren't in public spaces. And so the impetus of that is never going to be a community phone call. You know, some people are like, oh, I went on such and such website and I saw a sex worker. Okay, don't go on the website.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. Yeah, don't go. Don't call the number.
Yeah. And so when you know, part of that is, you know, there are definitely places where community complaints are really kind of forcing the hand, or there's a mayor who comes in who wants to show that they're tough on crime and puts a lot of pressure on your police chief to prove that. And so wants to parade around, you know, 15 arrests to show that they are good on crime. And so, you know, there are some of those community complaints, but I know law enforcement and, you know, knowing your audience, I recognize, like, y'all don't have a choice sometimes to respond. And that's not even close to most of these arrests. A lot of them are sting operations that are done on people who are not in public spaces. And so that is a really, that is something that I think there should be more conversation about. One of the other challenges, especially when you're talking about harm reduction, is that so buying, selling, loitering, all of those are criminalized. In addition, and this is something that's now true on a federal level and every single state, there's laws called promotion of prostitution, facilitation of prostitution, third-party laws. And a lot of these were passed with the idea of like, oh, we can't imagine that anyone would ever voluntarily do sex work. We have to imagine that they're being forced by someone else. So we need to criminalize these third-party behaviors. But what that does is actually really destroy the ability to engage in harm reduction tactics and to build community. And that's one of the hardest things for sex worker organizations to kind of navigate around. And so when people say, well, we wouldn't, you know, shut down a sex worker organization under third-party laws, well, most of the behaviors that are keeping people safe from violence and from trafficking fall under those laws. So when we say facilitation of prostitution, you know, that is really, really broad, is that someone I know is going to see this client and that person comes to me and says, hey, have you ever seen them? Can you tell me what they're like? If I respond, that's facilitation of prostitution. And I'm liable for what is even a higher level misdemeanor than if I was just trading sex myself. If I offer someone a place to trade sex safely, that's actually illegal under third party laws. And so one of the challenges when we're talking about a safe place to trade sex, you're talking about places that are criminalized and hyper-criminalized a lot of times. You know, brothel keeping can be a safe place to trade sex. It's indoors. There's someone else there. Isolation and lack of connection to other people means vulnerability. And the response that I always get is like, oh, brothels are exploitative. No, labor can be exploitative, but it doesn't actually have to be. And so when we look at the history of brothels, when brothels first came up in this country, they were almost exclusively women owned. And they were owned by people who were former sex workers who got older. Because what happens when you get a job? You get promoted into management and all of a sudden you oversee people. Sex industry isn't anything.
I guess that's a good way of looking at it.
You know how hard it is to manage people who are young and ugh.
Yeah.
And so when we look at the way that we criminalize third parties, what we're very often criminalizing is the harm reduction techniques that would keep people safe.
You talked about our nation should be embarrassed by the way that we don't have resources to help facilitate people to stay out of the situations that they are in. Do you do a comparative to other nations, other particularly first world countries, and how they deal with their sex worker problems, if they have any, or if they consider them problems?
So there's actually only, there's a lot of different ways that countries have approached the legal regimes of sex work. The United States is the most criminalized in the entire global North. We criminalize every single aspect, like I was saying. And that actually makes us really unique in terms of global North countries. There's only one country in the world that has full decriminalization. And what that means is, you know, there are industry regulations, but just like every other industry, they were developed in consultation with workers and with the industry. And so New Zealand, you don't face criminal penalties from participating in the sex trade, but they do have kind of oversight and regulation similar to other industries. And there's called New South Wales. And as of yesterday, I don't want to date this podcast. As of November 26th, there is a second province in Australia that just fully decriminalized. And what they found is that when you're looking at different schemes of regulation, so there's some places in Europe where they criminalize the buying, not the selling. There's some places in Europe which have legalization structures like red light districts. What they found is that decriminalization has the best health and safety outcomes for people that trade sex. They've called New South Wales the healthiest sex industry in the entire world. When they decriminalized in New Zealand, people felt more comfortable going to police when they were victimized, had better relationships with police overall if something was going wrong. They felt more able to refuse clients, and they felt more able to negotiate with management. That's what we look for when we're talking about health and safety and fighting exploitation, is all of those things. And so when we look at these other regimes, you know, sex workers don't want the Nordic model. Sex workers don't want legalization. Sex workers want decriminalization. And it's because no matter where you are in the industry, no matter what you're experiencing, you want to do, you want to be safer.
So if you do, is it your proposition that if we allowed some form of legalization and or regulation, that the amount of STDs, the amount of drug overdoses and all the other harms that come with the illicit types of sex trading would decrease?
So I advocate for decriminalization. Legalization is more like what you would see in Amsterdam, where it's hyper-regulated and the barriers are pretty high. And it's often confined to very certain spaces and really does, in a lot of those ways, privilege management over workers. I would say that under decriminalization, we know that violence goes down. We know that HIV and STI transmission goes down. There's a study that came out a couple of years ago. It's a global public health publication that says that if we fully decriminalize the sex trade, HIV transmission would drop 33% to 46% in a decade, which is incredible. Like, those are astronomical numbers when we're talking about HIV. So yes, under full decriminalization, you have the ability to, your ability to negotiate for things like condom use changes. Your ability to access safer spaces changes. Your ability to negotiate overall changes. And so what we know is that rates of violence, rates of exploitation, and rates of STI transmission are all likely to drop.
Wow. Wow. So give us an example of someone who's come to you or to your services. You've done what you had to do as far as the harm reduction, and now they want to leave this lifestyle, and what the obstacles they face, as because we talked about before, the obstacles that they face when they that they don't have services, right? So therefore, they're you use the term, I think you said basically they re-enter the sex trade again. So what obstacles are they facing? Not enough housing, not enough jobs. So what does their life go through? Give us a sample of what their life may be.
Sure. And actually, I got a message from someone last night to have this exact conversation. You know, as a community organizer, there's this other idea out there that, like, if you organize sex workers, you, like, want everyone to be a sex worker. I don't think anyone if they want to. You know, I don't think that anyone who doesn't want to trade sex should ever, ever have to. I think people that want other options should have a million other options. I think people that are trading sex for a place to sleep tonight, if they just want a place to sleep tonight, they should have choices for where they can go based on their situation. And so I have worked with a lot of people who are like, I'm done. I don't do this anymore. Something in my life is going to change. Like, let's talk about what that means. And it's really, really hard for a lot of people. Like you already said, you know, finding living wage jobs that are responsive to your circumstances is tough. How many single moms do we know who are struggling to raise their kid, to do it with enough money that it takes to raise their kid in the way that they want, to find childcare that's responsive, who feel like they can take off a day of work when their kid is sick and not have to worry that they're going to get fired? Like, that is hard anyway. That should be horrifying to us, that we say to caregivers, like, good luck. That's terrible. That's unacceptable. And so first and foremost, it's sitting down with folks and saying, all right, what do you want to do? And what do we have to get to overcome the barriers that you face? Whether or not that's, you know, for someone that's neurodivergent, is it about finding a job that has a lot of flexibility to it and saying, how do you have this conversation with your potential employer to, in a way that you feel safe, where you know if something happens and you have to take off some time, how can we work around that? How can we figure out what to do? If it's something like a criminal record, you know, that bars people from accessing certain types of employment that they really want to engage in. And that's really hard. Sometimes there's no way around that. Sometimes it's about expunging a record or finding out if we can expunge a record, to make sure that that doesn't come up when they do start seeking that job. And then at the like very, very basic and very tough part is sometimes you're talking to someone who is putting together their resume, and what do you do with a 5-year gap? And so what can we piece together to really sit down and say, how have you worked in community spaces? How have you been an activist? And what can we point out as the skill sets from there? How do we highlight the things that you have done? You know, sex workers are not just incredibly resilient people. Sex workers are ingenious. You're talking about very often people who know how to market themselves, know how to go out and find clients, know how to manage their money, know how to...
I guess I never really looked at it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you sit down with folks that say, hey, I had really hard circumstances and I made my life work. That's incredible. There's so much there to draw from that employers should be grasping at. And so how do you work with someone to say, let's put together your resume. Let's get you to talk about your life in a way that honors the incredible person that you are. How do you do that in an interview? And how do we make sure that the things that have been barriers for you to access formal employment are not going to just pop up and ruin this a month into your work? How do you address the barriers that put you here in the first place?
I promise you, I'm not trying to make fun of this, but it's got to be difficult. And if you could give us any success stories about someone who's gone for a job interview and put on their resume that I was a marketing genius, and I made the best out of my circumstances, trying to explain this 5-year gap. And meanwhile, they were some type of sex worker. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and absolutely, mm-hmm. that's good and powerful stuff. But translating that into going through a job for McDonald's or trying to become an office worker has got to be a little very difficult for people to really take that type of talk seriously.
Oh, absolutely. And so part of what I'm saying often it comes down to the other forms of privilege. You know, if there's someone who has a 5-year gap because they were engaged in the sex trade and they were also part of a community organization, saying like, look, you volunteered with us. Let's talk about your skills. Let's not talk about this in a timeline. Let's talk about the skills that you have. Let's talk about how you're an incredible graphic designer because you've made flyers for us for the last 5 years.
Are there flyers? I mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, and I say that because I'm really bad at it. So, you know, I recognize the level of skill that is. Are there ways that we can, you know, find you quick gigs here and there to build the number of people who are willing to be references for you, where we can build a portfolio about how you threw this fundraiser, and talk about that. You know, sometimes it's about writing a resume in a way that is a little non-traditional, but you know, for a lot of people, and especially when you're talking about people who face really serious structural barriers because of criminalization, because of homelessness and housing instability, you know, folks who are current substance users and it's just not physically an option to end anymore. Like all of those things make it that much more difficult. And so part of what I'm talking about is a group of people who have found enough stability to where this works. Sometimes it's just about finding the ways that we can piece resources together. Are there peer outreach jobs that are going to honor that your work in the community means that you have access to people who need resources, who are not coming to drop-ins, who are not being found by mobile units that are too scared to go into X, Y, or Z neighborhood? You know, maybe that is the right job that honors your skill set. And so it's, you know, when I talk about resumes and graphic design, that is a particular area of privilege. And I will fully acknowledge that. And it's easier to talk about those stories because those are the stories that we talk about when it comes to success. But I think also we need to redefine what we mean by success. If someone comes from a background and has made sex work work for them, that's success. If someone says, I wake up every day and I live the life that honors me, who I am, and the way that I want to present myself to the world, where I feel honored, where I feel valued, where I'm in my community space and I don't have to put on like work drag and show up in a way that doesn't feel true, or that where I'm waiting for someone to misgender me. You know, if that is true, then that is success. I think when we talk about success for a lot of different people, living in a way that's honest and that's real and that honors who they are and honors that commitment to life every single day, I think that's incredibly successful.
Right. I think that you have such an uphill battle with really trying to break down that stigma within society. And let me just say, I think it's a hypocritical stigma within society, right? Because there was a saying before something like 95% of men watch porn while the other 5% are lying about it, right? I know that they tried to do studies on porn and, you know, how many people watch it. And they couldn't get enough people who did not watch it, that nobody would admit to not watching it, or, you know, just, it's just a, such a hypocritical view of society. And I watched this show called 90 Day Fiancé. And one of the recent, did you watch that show?
I love 90 Day Fiancé.
It's a great, great show. So did you see the show? The most recent episode was when, it won't be recent by the time this comes out, but one of the episodes was where the, one of the grandmother of a child wanted to talk to one of the new 98 day fiance females. And she, first thing that the grandmother says is, listen, I just want to let you know offhand that I am a porn star. I don't know if you saw that episode or not, but just, So she wanted to get that out in the open just in case somebody said something to her, somebody heard, right? Because this whole stigma is I can cancel you, right? This cancel culture that we live in, that I don't have to listen to this particular person because of her line of work, right? Because of she's a porn star. And so I think that stigma is so heavily ingrained into this culture that it's going to take a lot of work to really break through that.
Oh, I don't disagree in the slightest. And, you know, that's a really long battle. And I think because the sex industry has been there for people that we have tried to destroy, whether because, you know, they're low-wage folks or people of color or trans folks or just poor women in general, you know, there's always going to be a stigma because this is the vehicle that a lot of people have stayed alive and have stayed resilient. And it's going to be a really long fight to honor that. And there's really nothing we can do about it. I work in policy and advocacy spaces for decriminalization, for economic empowerment, for labor rights, for anti-violence. And all of those face a lot of challenges. I'm a mixed race person, like interracial couples, my parents face stigma. I'm a queer person. And, you know, I have experienced incredible discrimination and stigma and had things said to me because I was with the person that I loved and it didn't look the right way. You know, I have tattoos. I work with people who have had abortions, who are substance users. It's definitely out there and it's definitely a very long fight that I will spend absolutely the rest of my life doing. But in policy and advocacy spaces, and you know, with your audience, I'm not coming here to tell you how you should feel about sex work. I am absolutely understanding that that is such a personal conversation about the body and commodification and sex and, you know, all of this under the lens of capitalism. That's a really deep conversation that I don't have a right to think that you should listen to me at all. All I'm saying is that under what we do now with criminalization, people are more likely to die. And you don't need to think that sex work is some great liberation to just say that people shouldn't be more likely to die because of these laws. And that's all I need to have a conversation with you about.
Right.
And then if we get to a conversation on stigma and how you feel, then I'm going to call in your therapist or at least charge therapist rates and we can have that conversation. But right now, all we're talking about is ending violence.
Now, you mentioned that you focus on persons of color. Why persons of color do you focus on them?
I think that, you know, social, we're about to get into some very macro stuff. You know, I think that in the U.S.
I'm game if you are.
You know, in the United States, we cannot talk about the development of our government, the existence of this country, and not talk about colonization and white supremacy. And so I very much see decriminalization as a conversation about social justice. Social justice is about factors that disproportionately impact people of color in a variety of different ways. Racism shows up differently for different communities. And centering people of color in that conversation is about centering people who are most impacted by structural inequity, by institutional violence, by state violence. And so making sure that we are centered on, if we're gonna upend white supremacy and heteropatriarchy, then we need to center femmes of color, because this is an entire country built on the backs of women of color and has survived on the backs of women of color. And so women of color are the ones where true change lives.
I could not agree more. I have been getting a little bit of pushback because people have said that I've been starting to focus too much on race. And of course, because I talk about police work all the time, or the vast majority of the time, I mean, you can't talk about police work and the history of the police society in this country without mentioning race. And in fact, I don't think that there's any, and I mean this any, capital A-N-Y, any subject we can talk about in this country that does not include some form of race, right? Every single social aspect, social conversation that we would have somewhere along the line is going to come down to race. That's just my
opinion. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All of these conversations have a racial dimension to it. If we ignore that, it is a privilege for people to feel like they can ignore the racial dimensions of these conversations.
Right. Right. And now your work with trans people, is that a lot? Is it heavy? Is it?
Yeah, I all the spaces that I work in are pretty queer led, and a number of them are led by trans folks. The decriminalization movement in DC is specifically led by Black trans women of color. And, you know, trans folks are definitely disproportionately impacted by a lot of these policies and by state violence, and are impacted in really unique ways that I think are incredibly important to highlight. For a lot of years, even the things that we saw as progressive still operated in a way that didn't really understand trans identity. And so I think it's really important to make sure that we have trans, gender nonconforming too, leadership and thought partnership, because when you're talking about trans folks, they're really disproportionately impacted, yes, by the need for informal labor, by the need to migrate to safer spaces. And very oftentimes, the services and the resources that we have still marginalize trans folks. You know, when we're right now on in the federal government, we're seeing the rollback of basic protection. And so when you're talking about informal labor and the way that people are staying economically solvent, you know, if it's legal to fire someone from a job because they're trans, if it's legal to kick them out of a shelter because they're trans, if it's legal to discriminate in healthcare settings because they're trans, what the fuck do you expect people to do? People have to survive. And, you know, like I said before, like it or not, sex work has provided an opportunity for survival, especially for queer communities, throughout our history.
I'd love to have a separate conversation. I don't know how much time you have, but I'd love to talk about the queer, movement, trans community in particular. Are you good for time, or should we save that for another episode or another time?
I am good for time, and I also would love to connect you to folks that are working really on this intersection and on this issue. And there's some amazing activists and organizers out there who have done some really spectacular work on the way that trans people are policed and impacted by criminalization.
Well, if there is someone who's a little more knowledgeable than you, you sound very knowledgeable. I'm certainly willing to talk about it. No, seriously, because I there's a lot that I don't understand. And listen, I studied this a little bit when I went back to school. I have a degree in psychology, so I looked at this a little bit, but I can't tell you that I understand it fully. I know that there's some brain differences and whatever's going on. And I need to understand this because I think that society needs to understand this. And I am in agreement with you that people should not be fired and kicked out of shelters and all that. And you're right. What do you expect people to do if you take all of their resources away from them in the way that they can live? So what do you expect them to do? But I am very curious as to understanding this whole situation. Matter of fact, I think part of your bio said that you use the pronouns if and she and they. Is that what you said? And now why do you use that?
Sure. So the term that I think is most representative of my experience of walking through the world is that I identify as femme. And I don't necessarily believe or subscribe to this idea that there is a gender binary. I think the way that we construct gender is pretty arbitrary. And the way that we define and assign what is female, what is feminine, the way that we describe what is male, who we connect to because of that, the way we see and treat each other, that just never felt right to me. And it never felt like something that was 100% natural. And so, you know, she is easy. I identify as feminine. Try not to, and this is an important part of connecting you to the right people. There are people who really experience gender discrimination in a way that I don't, because I'm always read as feminine. I'm outwardly presenting in a way that people look and they say, oh, she's very feminine and very girly. And sure, you can read me like that. And it's not necessarily true to who I am. You know, sometimes you look at someone and you're like, you look just like a Ted. I don't know why, but for some reason you look like a Ted to me. And they might say, actually, my name is Jacob. And, you know, we do that with names. We're like, all right, you look like a Ted to me, but I'm going to call you Jacob because that's who you are and that's true to you. And so for me, if someone uses she, that's fine. If someone uses they or them pronouns. So if I walk into a room, drop off a book and walk out, you would say, oh, that's Kate. They left this book. The same way we would use it for multiple people, but we just use it for one in the singular in this way. And it's really because I see gender as much more fluid. I see gender as not necessarily male on one side and female on the other. And I just feel more comfortable when I know that people use pronouns to reflect that fluidity because they want to respect the way I feel in the world. And so when people use they, it's great. When people use she, it's fine. When people use both, that's actually awesome.
You and I had such a great conversation up to this point. And I'm going to disagree respectfully. And I would certainly put me in contact with other people who may be a little more. But you sound very feminine to me. You present very feminine just in a way, from what I remember our conversation in St. Louis. And so, I would call you a she. If you put the book down, I would say she put the book here. And I guess what I have a problem with, and I think that many other people have a problem with, when people want to be something different and they want to be, you want to be presented as masculine, that word has to mean something. Feminine has to mean something. And so, listen, I certainly don't want to go off on a tangent that people deserve any type of disrespect that they get and or violence that comes towards them. I abhor that concept altogether. But let me just present this to you. If you were going to buy a dog, and I hate to use this analogy, people are not dogs, I get it, I understand that. But if you wanted a male dog because you wanted that male dog to procreate and you want to create your own dog business, selling puppies and whatever, you don't want a female dog. You don't want a dog you want a dog that's going to be able to do what it's designed to do. And to say that humanity for some reason is outside of this this box, this, as you call it, gender fluidity, I think that presents a great problem to people. And I think that I, for one, don't understand it. And I think, and I have a problem with it. And I can have a problem with it and still agree with you that people ought not to be suffer violence or be kicked out of shelters or be fired because they present a different way.
And I think this is definitely a larger conversation to have. I would say that I would say that feminine and masculine and who can carry a child, those are not the same thing. And, you know, if you wanted two dogs who could procreate, why does that inform what you expect of their personality or the name that you would give them? I think that doesn't necessarily make sense. And so I definitely don't identify as masculine. If someone said used he, him pronouns for me, I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. We would have to talk about that.
but what would, now here's where we get off into this tangent. Here's where we get off into the problems with is you would want someone to respect you and where you are. But what about if I say, well, I think that you present this way, how about you respect me, right? So this idea of respectability can really get kind of hairy and complicated. And like you said, we'd have to have a conversation about this. Well, I want to present, I think that you're, even though your name is Kate, I'd like to present you. You look more like a Frank to me. So I'm going to call you Frank because I think you present as masculine. You don't. But I see you this way. And how about you, Kate, or Frank now, respect my intuitions, the way that I feel and how I want to present you. Where does this stop at?
When someone says, this is the name that I want to use, and this is the pronoun that feels respectful for me, I don't consider it a disrespect to honor how that person sees themselves.
Fair enough. Let's get back to where this sex driving, sex work thing. So we'll wrap this up. Thank you so much for being on. So how can the members of the public, there's not much that law enforcement can do, because as you mentioned before, people are officers are under the direction of the chief of police, who's under the direction of the mayor, who's getting complaints from citizens. So the officers have to do what they have to do. They have to conduct the stings, and they have to, for lack of better terms, harass these streetwalkers and everything like that.
Well, I would say that there are definitely things that officers can do. And I know it's hard because of the structure of policing.
Okay.
But I think that voicing and saying, you know, I don't think this works, you know, sitting down with a law enforcement officer who arrests the same substance user over and over again, the same chronically homeless person over and over again, throws them in jail and says, well, we keep getting community complaints that this person is sleeping on a park bench and people don't want that individual sleeping on a park bench. And so I go, I arrest them, I throw them in jail. They get a citation that they can't afford. I arrest them again 2 weeks later. A lot of officers are starting to really feel empowered to say, I shouldn't be dealing with this, and I don't have the resources to help this person. And this is setting up a worse situation. This person is not any better because I throw them in jail and give them a ticket. And so I think that officers can start saying, you know, I go and I have to do these sting operations. People hate me. Sex workers resent me. Sex workers are afraid of me and avoid me. And what happens if one of them is assaulted? I would much rather have sex workers that feel safe, that they can come to me and tell me what's happened, that if they feel threatened, that they're willing to call me. If they are being trafficked, they're willing to call me. And because I go out and arrest them and do these sting operations, they don't trust me. I think officers have, I would love to say, I think they have a duty to say that. But I'm sure a lot don't feel like they do. But what they do have is the opportunity and the voice to say it. And ultimately, there's a lot of officers that know that this is true. And so, you know, yes, I understand that there are pressures, there are outside pressures. And I think that if officers start actually saying, look, this isn't working. I don't have the resources. I'm not the right person. And I think this might be creating more harm than good. I think that would make a huge difference.
Mm, I would agree. And can you speak to the public? What can they do if they have a member who's a sex worker or on drugs, or, you know, give out a website? What would you say to someone
There's a lot of different organizations. There might be some in your community. There's a national organization called the Sex Workers Outreach Project, SWOP, S-W-O-P, that has something like 26 different chapters. I used to be one of the organizers for the SWOP New York City chapter, and now we have in New York City a couple different chapters, which is so exciting. I know there's people organizing in Connecticut, but SWOP is a great place to start to find out where there are organizations close to you. If you do have someone who either you're friends with or who is in your family who has worked in the sex trade or maybe still does, honestly, the greatest thing you can do is listen, be respectful, and just keep loving people. Because when we talk about the harms, I do harm reduction trainings for sex workers all the time, and we talk about a lot of different harms that people identify and ways that people can mitigate that harm. But one of the greatest things that people identify is feelings of isolation, feelings of stigma, being afraid to tell people in their family and feeling alone, the emotional exhaustion of having to lie to people that you love. And so if you know a sex worker, if you know someone who's in your family, just be supportive. Be the person that you would want to be if they were going to come and tell you anything else they were afraid of. And don't judge, and listen, and say, hey, I love you.
Very good. Thank you so much. Now, your organization, can people reach you or your organization? Or?
Sure. We are ReframeHealthAndJustice.com. Like I said, we are a queer and trans people of color consulting organization that works at the intersection of harm reduction, healing justice, and criminal legal reform. So we do advocacy work, consulting, and strategy work for organizations, as well as support for community-based organizations that are looking to either expand their work or shift their work.
Very good. Thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, truly enjoyed the conversation. I would like to have you back so we can continue this another time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I want to thank my special guest, Kate D'Adamo, for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. Great, great conversation. I do want to have her back on, and I'm looking forward to hooking up with some other persons from her agency to talk about trans issues. Because I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. So we'll work to set that up. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you all enjoyed the podcast. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. Please answer those questions that I talked about at the beginning of the podcast. How did you find out about the podcast? Why are you listening? Is it a friend or certain topics? Do you get notifications? Are you subscribed? And do you download the episodes? Once again, this is for marketing purposes in order for me to continue to expand the message. I want to know what avenues are working and which ones are not working. That way I can target certain persons. Also, let me know. I'm just kind of thinking about this too. Also, let me know if you're listening as a member of law enforcement, or if you are a community activist, or you're just someone who just likes to listen to podcasts and likes the different topics that we're talking about. So we'll put that down as the fifth question. Law enforcement, yes or no? Community activists, yes or no, or just someone who's just enjoys the topics and likes listening to podcasts. So thank you once again. I look forward to hearing back from you. CPTLHunter@gmail.com. Instagram, Twitter, both of those are CPTLHunter. Cash App, PayPal, Venmo, CPTLHunter. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, much love and peace.